Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ along with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, an accident I-10 eastbound at 19th Avenue. Valley forecast calling for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high of 90 degrees. That would be 15 degrees warmer than average, by the way. Clear skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the upper 50s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 74, 79 on Sunday. Right now, partly cloudy, 79 degrees at KJZZ.
A pair of bills making their way through the legislature this session have drawn some criticism for their insensitivity to refugees and undocumented immigrants. One is HB 2370, the other is SB 1377. It would require an undocumented person who commits certain crimes to be sentenced to prison for the maximum amount of time that's permitted. Senator Steve Smith is the bill's sponsor, and he joins me now. Senator, why do we need this legislation?
Well, it's in response to, a tragedy that we had last year in Mesa with Grant Ronenbeck, a 21-year-old kid that was murdered at the QT convenience store. And so that's why in the bill we're affectionately calling it Grant's Law. And, I'll give you the 10-second background story on it. I mean, here you had an illegal alien that with an accomplice broke in somebody's house, basically held a woman hostage for about a week, raped her repeatedly, and effectively got off with probation, didn't really serve any jail time, and subsequently then found himself in front of Grant Ronenbeck at a QT location and shot him in the face and murdered him. And so had this person been in jail, hopefully Grant would still be alive.
Does this come from a place of fear or safety or protection? How do you characterize it?
This comes right from the place of providing justice for a family whose son was murdered. And I introduced a version of this bill last year when this initially happened, and well before, I'm sure we're all familiar with Kate Steinle and Kate's Law out of San Francisco that was being moved in Congress. Mm-hmm. I had Grant's Law before there's a Kate's Law. But why do you see that push? Kate's Law is not out of fear. It's out of frustration. It's out of a legal system that is abuse the citizenry here by not locking up those that need to be locked up.
There are also critics who are saying these couple of bills remind them of the days of SB 1070. How would you respond?
I would encourage people to go watch the testimony. My bill is not have anything to do, if people want to bring up SB 1070, it has nothing to do with first, a certain race. This is anybody in the country legally. Matter of fact, Grant's father, when he spoke in the Senate hearing, mentioned about how there was an illegal Frenchman who was in here in the country and did a heinous crime. So this is for anybody. If you show contempt for our laws the first time by either overstaying your welcome or breaking into the country, this is now strike two. But more importantly, this has nothing to do with profiling, has nothing to do with any kind of race baiting people want to put around it. This is post trial. So when somebody is brought up on charges and convicted in a court of law, we're only talking about how much jail time they're going to serve.
State Senator Steve Smith, we appreciate the time.
Hey, thank you, sir.
Faith leaders in Arizona have come together to speak out against SB 1377 and HB 2370. One of those leaders is Reverend Aaron Tamayo, Executive Director of the Arizona Faith Network. And Reverend, are you afraid this legislation will send a negative message about Arizona to the rest of the world?
I'm definitely afraid of that. As you know, Arizona has been kind of a harsh environment for immigrants and refugees alike. And as a person of faith and as an executive director of a faith network, mm-hmm. these are things that we really hold tightly to, is this need to support the most vulnerable in our communities, including refugees, including immigrants. A lot of our faith documents, our faith directives discuss that we need to create a place where sojourners and refugees feel comfortable when they are persecuted in other lands. And so specifically, if we're going to be making a hostile environment for the most vulnerable, this goes against everything that we believe.
Maybe it's the year of politics and the presidential election year. It feels like people are more fearful of things that maybe in the past they would have been thinking more first, how can I help this person, as opposed to thinking fear first. You think I'm leaping too much there or no?
No, I totally agree. I think that people are reacting out of fear. They're reacting out of what they don't understand, different religions, different ethnicities, different places around the world. And what they're not really understanding is what I'm learning as well, is that refugees are some of the most, they go through a long screening process that's just so extensive that you and I can't even imagine.
Is there more clarity to you in what God says and what the Bible says as far as how you treat your fellow man?
I believe as far as faith leaders, many of us can agree that this is one of those that you don't question. How do you treat the most vulnerable? How do you treat your community members that have already gone through so much difficulty in their own places and they're looking for refuge? That's not questionable.
I just had one more question for you, and it's related to sort of the perception of what happened with SB 1070.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem that since the backlash of that, certainly leading up to it, this wasn't the case, but afterwards, it did seem like community leaders, faith leaders, business leaders have said, you know, we don't want this again. Are you concerned that in some cases, we're gathering up momentum to sort of head back toward that direction?
Yes, I am. As you know, we've had some of the most anti-immigrant, anti-refugee laws in Arizona over the past decade, with the pinnacle of that being SB 1070. And now that some of SB 1070 has been knocked down, we are worried that there is this movement to introduce new laws that will do some of the same things that SB 1070 did, which will make Arizona very hostile, very anti-immigrant, very anti-stranger, and be very hostile for people, not just immigrants and strangers, but everyone living here in Arizona, small businesses, faith leaders, people who are documented and undocumented alike.
Reverend Aaron Tamayo, Executive Director of the Arizona Faith Network.
More Americans are forming new households now than over the past few years. That includes both rentals and home ownership. Louise Keeley is president of the Demand Institute, which studies this. And Louise, the numbers are up?
Finally, yes, there are more households being formed. So one of the kind of mysteries after the financial crisis and recession, as the housing market was recovering, we still didn't see the creation of new households that one would expect, given demographic trends, the aging of millennials to a point where, you know, you normally would expect they'd be forming their own household. Immigration rebounded. And so net household formation during and after the financial crisis dropped off. And it really wasn't until the past year and a half that we've seen household formation go back to the level that you would expect it to be given long-term demographic trends. And we never really made up that gap. You know, household formation in 2010 dropped down to well under a million households, like about 500,000 households per year. And the long-term demographic trend that you'd expect is 1.2 to 1.3 million households being formed every year. And we're back to that average now.
So what do these numbers tell you about maybe the overall economy or just about demographics in general?
The main demographic trend that was driving the drop in household formation was what was happening with younger adults. So they just weren't forming the household at the rate that you would expect. And this is actually part of a long-term decline in or delay of forming households, of getting married, of having children. All of these decisions are becoming delayed. Even today, half of adults 18 to 34 live on their own, but nearly a third live with their parents. So these young adults, they weren't forming households, they weren't striking out on their own, and even as the unemployment rate started to fall, they still weren't going out and forming their own households, and that could be due to lack of confidence, it could be due to underemployment or taking lower income, lower wage jobs than young adults in earlier generations might have taken.
Well, something that I thought was particularly interesting is that we've been hearing for a while now that younger people, millennials and other younger people, weren't necessarily buying houses because either they couldn't afford them or they saw what their parents went through as far as foreclosures and things like that during the housing crisis. But rentals seem to be sort of on the rise. But based on this data, it sounds like in many cases, millennials and other younger people weren't even doing that.
Yeah, they weren't even doing that. So they weren't even forming their own households to rent. Now, it has been the case that with household formation, so with the household formation that has taken place, that the vast majority of it has been the formation of renter households. So as young adults and others form new households, the vast majority are renting, not owning.
Did you find the same kinds of trends as far as household formations in places like Arizona, the Southwest, and the West as the rest of the country?
So in terms of the regional variation, there's tremendous variation across different parts of the country. And household formation is actually stronger in the southern half of the U.S., and we expect that to continue. The places like Arizona and other places in the Southwest that were disproportionately hit by the housing market crisis saw bigger drops in home prices, bigger drops in the home ownership rate, and probably also lower household formation within the, I'll call it the kind of the population already there. But on the other hand, there's also a longer term movement of population toward the south of the U.S. And so that counterbalances to some extent what was happening internally within these markets, what's happened.
Louise Keeley is president of the Demand Institute. Louise, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Fans of baseball analytics are in the valley for the Society of American Baseball Research, or SABR, conference on the subject. One of tomorrow's panels will focus on the business of baseball. Dan Magala will moderate that discussion. He's the founder and chief innovation officer of PCG and Sports Desk Media. It's a sports marketing consulting firm in Chicago. Dan, baseball has been trying to speed up its games over the past few seasons. Do you think now its reputation as kind of a slow-paced, leisurely game is still warranted?
Well, I mean, the root of baseball, just as a brand, America's pastime, right? It does have those parallels, and I think one of the things that was once romantic about baseball and leaning back and exhaling from a stressful day now seems a little bit different when fans and consumers, we like to say, move at the speed of digital in a faster-paced life that you know, really the game hasn't changed, but our lives as consumers, fans, has rapidly changed.
When you talk about trying to almost recruit new fans to the game, how much of that do you think goes sort of beyond what's on the field to other stuff going on inside the stadium, be it a wiffle ball field or the pool at Chase Field, to museums and other types of activities that other newer parks are implementing?
I think it speaks volumes about where the game is going and how baseball to that point, because you do have 81 home games to fill, you've got a lot of opportunities for segmented promotions, segmented experiences to speak to different audiences. So, and I think actually that's a lesson that Major League Baseball has really learned from minor league baseball, you know, that traditionally Sundays are family days, Thursdays are Thirsty Thursdays, that's more of a 20-something crowd. You know, you've got the Saturday night fireworks show that you look at it almost in the same way that a TV producer is going to look at his weekly lineup, that there's different audiences that they're really trying to grow each night of the week and provide those entertainment options for them. And also, too, we're in such a data-rich environment that I think teams have gotten incredibly smart and sophisticated, what I like to call Moneyball for the other side of the hallway, in the ticketing department, fan engagement, and even sponsorships, of how they can really use data to identify new fans and go pursue them and really look to maybe think big but focus small in terms of their outreach to specialize and really backfill the stadiums in a more unique way that 10 years ago was not possible.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of data, because forever baseball has really been about stats. It's really the way that you can compare players from different eras and players even within the same era. Given the prevalence now of data everywhere coming at us, is that something that baseball can use to its advantage to bring in a new generation of fans, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think the repeatable process for Major League Baseball, for minor league baseball, would be how do you use data to to solve a business problem. And if they can really start to identify a particular fan base that is really engaging with their team or league, and this fan starts to look like a lot of other ticket buyers, you can use data and a lot of technology with what they call almost like a lookalike model that goes finds in other people that look exactly like you on the internet, and then they can look to transact with them.
Dan Magala is the founder and chief innovation officer of PCG and Sports Desk Media. That's a sports marketing consulting firm in Chicago. He'll be moderating a panel discussion on the business of baseball tomorrow morning as part of the Saber Analytics Conference in Phoenix.
It's the show for Friday, March 11th. Along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today, I'm Mark Brody. This week, a former security official with the self-proclaimed Islamic State leaked a trove of documents to German security officials and the British media, giving Westerners a new understanding of the fighters who have dedicated themselves to ISIS.
In the opinion of the security services, these documents are, in all probability, authentic. They show how conscientious this criminal organization is, and in part at least, how effective it is.
German Interior Minister Thomas Meiser in a BBC translation there. The documents contain personal information for thousands of ISIS fighters. It has names, addresses, phone numbers for recruits from at least 40 countries. There has been some speculation as to the accuracy of those documents, and we're going to talk about that with Rukmini Kalamaki. She's foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Todd.
A 23-question questionnaire that you have to fill out if you want to join ISIS. What are we learning about the recruits and the fighters who are signing up?
What we're learning is that ISIS is just as bureaucratic as it promises to be. Keep in mind that Al-Qaeda as well used to have a formulaire for intake interviews of their new recruits, very similar to the one here where it asks for blood type, mother's maiden name. So ISIS seems to be continuing in that tradition.
What about ideology? There's a lot of HR type stuff in there, but they also want to know if you're loyal. They might want to know if you're willing to be a martyr.
Very similar to Al-Qaeda in that regard. I think that ISIS is very much an extension of Al-Qaeda in terms of its HR structure and its bureaucracy.
And what did we learn about the identities of some of the fighters we might have been looking for or might have been already in the media?
So far, what I'm hearing is people who have been able to look at some of these files have been able to confirm that specific fighters that they were researching, that the details regarding those fighters are correct. I haven't yet learned any details that we didn't know about these people. So for instance, one of the names that appears is Junaid Hussein, who was a very famous British member of ISIS, a suspected hacker who was killed in a drone strike a couple of months ago. So his personal details are there, and people who have studied him say that those match up. However, as you pointed out, there have been some issues regarding other aspects of the documents that have led some people to question whether they are authentic, including the fact that the flag that appears at the top of the formulaire is not the ISIS flag, which is somewhat curious.
Oh, what does that tell us? That it might have been a Photoshop or someone trying to recreate a document and they were lazy?
Well, the working theory right now is that the data is accurate. So the names of these fighters, their personal information, that part is accurate. But that somebody who was trying to sell these to an intermediary or might have been trying to sell it to the British press, which sadly is somewhat of a common practice at the border between Turkey and Syria, that they wanted to dress it up, you know, to make it look like what they thought ISIS would look like. And instead, they just made some pretty glaring stylistic errors.
Tried to throw some letterhead on there and make it look ISIS-y, in other
exactly.
words.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
There's intelligence and then there's actionable intelligence. Mm-hmm. Does this fall into the latter category? Is this the kind of thing that our intelligence services would not have known anyway? If not, is it the kind of thing that they can act on, target people, find out more about them that they didn't already know?
I think it's more interesting from the prosecution standpoint. So, and especially for our partners in Europe, what I'm hearing from my colleague in Berlin is that they knew the names of the German members of ISIS. But because when you join ISIS, it's not necessarily something public, you know, so family members might see a Facebook post that looks suggestive. Now German officials have the names of these people and an application form that essentially states that they have joined ISIS, including a person who is on trial right now. For that suspect, this could prove to be a very useful piece of information that will lead to that person being prosecuted.
Still, there's a chance in what you're saying there that somebody here in the United States could get a knock on the door that they haven't gotten before.
I would certainly hope that our officials have identified what U.S. citizens have joined ISIS, but perhaps I'm wrong.
So, Rukmini Kalamaki, what does this tell us about the value of ISIS intelligence like this, not only to British reporters who are willing to pay for it, but to others who might pick up leaks like this at the border?
Well, I can draw from my own experience. In 2013, I was covering France's military intervention in Mali, and I was able to reach the city of Timbuktu that had been occupied for almost a year by Al-Qaeda's North African branch. And what was shocking to me is that before fleeing, they had left thousands and thousands of pages of documents behind. And they hadn't bothered really, you know, to either pick them up or to destroy them. And they were literally there for journalists like me to pick up. And that trove of documents that I was able to obtain in 2013 has forever changed my understanding of Al-Qaeda. And what I learned from that experience is that these groups are very bureaucratic. They have to be because they have thousands of fighters. They have limited resources, so they need to marshal their finances in the best possible way, which leads to receipts, which leads to accounting, which leads to expense reports. And all of that involves paper. And when they're fleeing, they generally don't have a good enough structure in place to get rid of their paper trail. And that paper trail, as soon as it's discovered by reporters, leads to insight into the group. And it's one of their security failures, you know, that they need this paper to run the other organization. And therefore, the paper trail then becomes a way for us to have a window into this terror group.
HR documents may be a bureaucratic leak from ISIS. New insights into how the terrorist organization operates in Iraq, Syria, and other countries. Rukmini Kalamaki, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. It was 5 years ago today that an earthquake and tsunami triggered a series of meltdowns at the Fukushima nuclear plant on the northeast coast of Japan. About 160,000 people were evacuated from the surrounding villages in the following weeks, and persistent high levels of radiation mean an exclusion zone remains in place. At least 100,000 people still can't go home. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes went back to find out what it's like now.
Entering the Fukushima contamination zone never becomes normal. In the little town of Okuma, the streets are completely silent. A traffic light changes from red to green and back again for cars that never come. After 5 years, the grass in the unkempt gardens is now well above head height.
This is basically debris from the earthquake 5 years ago, still lying on the ground here. Bits of roof, broken glass, still lying just where it was.
Nothing here has been touched, and there is no plan to start cleaning this place up anytime in the foreseeable future.
Shiga-san,
konnichiwa.
Yoshihiro Shiga has had to get special permission to come back home today, and he's only done it because I've asked him to. As he does on every one of these trips, he first measures the radiation levels around his old house. He points his Geiger counter to the bottom of a drain pipe. The needle flips to the right. It's especially high down here, he tells me. The rain washes the radiation off the roof and it collects at the bottom here. Inside his house, it is worse every time he comes back.
It looks like a bomb's hit inside here. Debris strewn everywhere. The roof, you can see the damp, the water coming through the ceilings here. Because, of course, for 5 years they haven't been able to touch this house. Animals get in, raccoons get in here. His family's lived here for more than 300 years, 18 generations. And now it's all gone.
どうでしょうね?
I hope my ancestors can forgive me, Shiga-san says. It's not my fault I cannot return here. I have a very deep attachment to this place. But if I admit that, it hurts too much. For 5 years, the people of Okuma have been told it is too dangerous for them to go home. But is it? Some experts now think not. Professor Jerry Thomas is one of Britain's leading researchers on the effects of radiation on the human body.
The way we've reacted to the accident has actually made things a lot worse.
Today, she's come with me into the exclusion zone to explain why she thinks the danger of radiation here is overstated.
Jerry, this is the first time you've been in here.
Yeah.
What's your initial reaction when you see this?
I think it's really sad because it doesn't look like Japan. I mean, Japan is a very neat country, and you come here and you can see that this has just been left a rack and ruin.
I mean, you're very much of the opinion that this is not necessary.
At the moment, it wouldn't be safe to come back because you haven't repaired the damage to the infrastructure. But in terms of radiation, the amount of radiation that we're getting now is very small. And if you were inside a building, you'd be getting less. If you stood out in the open air all day and didn't move from these spots, then you'd be getting around about an extra millisievert a year, which is not very much when you consider our background doses are about 2 millisieverts a year. And if you had a CT scan, it would be 10 millisieverts.
And so an extra 1 millisievert a year, what is the long-term impact on your health?
Absolutely nothing.
Back at Mr. Shiga's home, it's now time to leave. He's loading the car with a few things that he's rescued from the chaos. 5 years after the meltdowns at Fukushima, 100,000 people are still unable to go home. If, as Professor Thomas believes, the danger from the radiation is being exaggerated, then it is making the human tragedy at Fukushima much worse than it should be.
That's the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting from Fukushima, Japan. There are a lot of factors at work in Syria's ongoing civil war, but scientists believe one of them is the worst drought in 900 years. Kevin Anchikaitis, an earth systems geographer, paleoclimatologist, and dendroclimatologist at the University of Arizona, is a co-author of a new report on this.
The finding that the current recent drought in the eastern Mediterranean, in the Levant, which includes Syria, was the most severe of the last 900 years, actually was accidental or fortuitous. We were looking at how droughts over the region had come and gone over the decades and centuries, and what we noticed was that over this particular part of the Mediterranean, that the drought that really started in 1998, that was particularly severe from 2006 through 2011, was actually the worst drought going all the way back 900 years in the past. And it was the only part of the region where that was the case. It was the only part of the region where we could say with some confidence that the recent drought was the most severe of that time period.
So how do you draw a connection from the worst drought over many, many centuries and what role that may or may not play in violence happening in that region?
So the connection between climate and conflict is a complicated one. We actually don't have any reason to think that conflict within a state like Syria, or even between nations, occurs solely because of climate variability or climate change. But what climate can do is exacerbate existing tensions. It can result in crop failure, hunger, internal migration. And these are the sort of things that, combined with other social, economic, or political conditions, can result in conflict.
It basically makes things worse.
Yes, exactly. That these conditions were already perhaps tenuous from a political and economic standpoint, and climate then piles on top of that.
So do you think that this kind of theory is applicable to other parts of the world? I mean, we're undergoing a pretty significant drought here in the West. Would that potentially lead to conflict or maybe push some bubbling problems over the top?
So it depends very keenly on, I think, existing other tensions. How well do we have systems that are able to absorb migration, for instance, or agricultural loss? To what extent are we buffered against existing problems that arise even without climate variability but are exacerbated or made worse by climate variability? So it's difficult to say whether one region could be susceptible to this. What we do know is that conflicts over water, so far in the past, have actually tended towards cooperation.
It seems like we've been hearing for a long time now that the next big resource that people will be fighting about, that countries or states will be fighting about, is water. Do you think that what you found in the Middle East and specifically in Syria lends any credence to that?
When we think about climate change as something that's perhaps going to happen in the future, well, the future is now. Climate change is already having an impact on water resources. So the bigger unknown is how people will respond to this. And conflict between states is certainly a possibility, but so is cooperation. We don't have to look very far in the future to realize that this is a conflict that's going to arise, because it's already arising now. And there's some suggestions that the conflict in Syria is the first where we can say with some confidence that climate made things worse.
Kevin Anchikaitis is an Earth Systems geographer, paleoclimatologist, and dendroclimatologist at the University of Arizona, and the co-author of a new report on the impact of the worst drought in 900 years on the ongoing civil war in Syria.
Today marks the first day of the McDowell Mountain Music Festival. Bands from around the valley and all across the country will begin taking the stage in just a few hours. The festival is headlined by nationally renowned acts like Beck and the Avett Brothers, but features local talent as well. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins is here with a preview. Jimmy, you're going to be taking the stage, well, like Saturday night?
No, Steve. I will happily just be a face in the crowd. But I did get a chance to talk with a few of the bands. I spoke with Bob Crawford from the Avett Brothers. He's the bass player and affectionately known as the third Avett Brother. I asked him why he thinks their brand of Americana music strikes such a chord with popular music fans.
When you were born, I promised myself I'd always be there for you, to help you feel safe and never alone, no matter what life puts you through. Time passed by, I lost my way, and didn't find it for years. A strong young woman now stands in her place, the child has disappeared. Now that I'm home, do you still want me here?
You know, I believe this about acoustic music. When you're playing electric and you're singing through a microphone, and you're playing electric guitar or electric bass, it's like someone's shouting at you. When you're playing an acoustic instrument like a mandolin or a fiddle, it's like someone's whispering in your ear. And I think that there's something, the warmth and the tones of those instruments, I think, touch something in us. There's a truth to them. There's an honesty, and I think it resonates with everyone pretty much.
How is a live show going to be different to what you put together for a studio album?
Yeah, you know, the two are completely night and day, and they're two different, it's like apples and oranges. We may have a song in the development stage for 7 years, 8 years, and it finally makes its way slowly to the top of the pile, and it gets recorded. And, you know, that's like, in some ways, you think of that as being the definitive version. But then, as time goes past that moment it was recorded and we continue to play it live, the song continues to change and grow and morph. And it's really exciting to be in a band where nothing is sacred.
Do you find that folk and bluegrass or Americana music plays everywhere, or is it more of a regional genre?
I think it plays everywhere. You know, when we were doing what we do, we were playing the punk rock clubs. I mean, we were playing punk rock clubs in New Jersey on bills with like five punk bands and us. Hmm. So, I mean, I think it goes back to the honesty factor that those instruments, they do something to us psychologically. They touch us somewhere, maybe even in a primal way.
So, Steve, the Avett Brothers will be on the main stage of the festival Sunday night, but in just a few hours, a local up-and-coming band called Mr. Mud and Mr. Gold will kick off the three-day festival. They take their name from a Townes Van Zandt song, so still very much in the folk Americana genre. They cite artists like Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly as influences.
Does it seem like there are more young artists that are looking back to older blues bands, older folk artists for inspiration?
Yeah, exactly. It seems like, you know, like they say, what was once old is now new again. This is one of the tracks from their debut album coming out this summer. It's their take on the Howlin' Wolf song, Killing Floor.
I should have quit you long time ago. Yeah, I should have quit you long time ago. I should have quit you, honey, and gone down to Mexico.
They're a two-man band. That blistering banjo you heard was Jesse Gray, and Tyler Mattock sings and plays guitar. Mattock told me playing on the same stage as such big established acts is going to be exhilarating, but also making him a little nervous.
when I first started playing music, I never really, like, I wasn't, like, imagining myself being on, like, these big festivals. Like, I was just writing songs and playing them. And then at each step, you know, next thing I knew, I was playing shows. And then next thing I knew, I was playing in front of, like, you know, good crowds. And then opening for, you know, touring bands and everything. And so this is just, like, that next thing, you know, it feels like that next step. So it almost kind of feels, natural. And it feels like where I'm supposed to be, but at the same time, I'm like a little kid inside, and I'm like, I'm so excited. I get nervous just talking about it, like a good nervous.
What kind of impact does a festival like this have on our local music scene?
There's so much talent out there in the Phoenix area, but because Phoenix is so big that, you know, everybody's kind of also kind of scattered, and I've always imagined, like, Phoenix having everything kind of come together and create like a genuine, like, music culture. And I see that happening, especially with this festival being, you know, downtown. And I think it's great because of people that maybe aren't as aware of the Phoenix music scene. This is definitely something that they can, you know, that they can maybe open up their eyes to and come check out.
That was Tyler Mattock of Mr. Mud and Mr. Gold. They're kicking off the McDowell Mountain Music Festival in downtown Phoenix in about an hour. And Steve, we'll link to the lineup for the whole festival on our website at kjzz.org.
And our own superstar, KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
You got it, Steve.
In the middle of a campaign season, a lot of us are looking at our phones or computers or TV screens to find out who has won a particular election. And many media outlets still wait for the Associated Press to call a winner before declaring it for themselves. With me to find out why that's still the case is David Scott, U.S. political editor for the AP. So, David, why does AP still stand tall on declaring election winners?
We're good at it. I think that's the answer as to, you know, why folks wait for us. I mean, one of the things that the AP does is we count the vote. We take in vote from all across the country. Down at the county level, we put stringers in county election board offices across states or all across the country, and we count the vote. And that's the only way that anyone knows on election night what the returns are, is because the AP is pulling that all together and sending that out to the world. There is no government agency that does that on a national level. There's no federal office of elections that pulls together all the information about who's winning where. It's the AP that does that vote count.
Can you give us a general idea of, for a major election year, like a presidential election year, how many people have you got out there?
On the night of a general election and in a presidential year, thousands. You know, thousands of people across the country who are at county election offices, counting, you know, they're not actually counting the vote, you know, obviously, you know, state, you know, county election officials, they do the actual tallying. And what we do is we get that information from them and compile it into state and then national totals. And that's what we say when we're counting the vote. But there's thousands of people who are involved in that process, both in at individual county election boards and then in our vote count centers where we, you know, tally all that information together.
How far in advance do you have to plan this? Is one election over and then 2 years later, you know, we better start planning now?
Yeah, it never really ends. You know, we're constant. We have a whole elections research department at the AP that is involved in this all the time. And it's a little bit like you say, when one election ends, we're moving right on to the next one. And there's even some overlap. So we're already planning for elections to come while this one is still underway.
It seems everyone gets something wrong. How do you avoid getting it wrong, or has there been one that AP got wrong and then you decide we needed to tighten up so we never get it wrong again?
Well, that's the goal, is to never get it wrong. Obviously, the goal is always to be right 100% of the time. We have made mistakes in the past. 2008, for example, we called the state of Missouri for Hillary Clinton during the Democratic primary, and we were wrong, as more vote than we expected came in from St. Louis City with a heavily African-American population. The vote switched, and Barack Obama won that primary. And so after that, we did a lot of research and a lot of sort of postmortem on looking into how we could do better, estimating a vote, and other changes that we could make to make sure that we didn't make that mistake again.
And so we're constantly looking at ways to make sure that, you know, we are getting all the information that we need to make race calls. And our rate of accuracy is really great. We didn't make any mistakes in the midterm election. We haven't made any so far this year, and I don't expect that we will.
Is there an excitement level in your bureau when you get to make the call, even if you're making many calls in a night? Is there that extra sort of momentum, that extra sort of energy that comes out of making a call?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, it's the most fun part of my job is when we get to make race calls, and I'm looking forward to this fall. I mean, I will hopefully be the person in our newsroom who gets to press the button on the AP news alert that says who the next president is, and that's an exciting moment to look forward to.
David Scott is U.S. political editor for the AP. The traditions of Native American music have been evident in American pop music for a century or more, but we may not notice or even realize those influences. That's part of what drove Jeff Berglund to be one of the editors of the new book, Indigenous Pop, Native American Music from Jazz to Hip Hop. He's also an English professor at Northern Arizona University, and he joins me. Jeff, how far back can we go in hearing these influences?
I would make a case that you can go back earlier to very local instances where anyone with access to instrumentation was making innovations and borrowing traditions of popular forms, from their neighbors if they were in neighboring tribal communities, or flash forward post-colonization and post-contact, where people were learning and borrowing from various traditions.
How would we define what Native American music is? Are there certain instruments we would naturally think of, certain types of sounds we'd naturally think of?
Well, I think, listeners in the Southwest might typically be thinking of instrumentation that's linked to two primary instruments, the flute and the drum. I would say that singers are as crucial, if not more crucial, than any type of instrumentation within the history of indigenous music. And if we think about the role of music within indigenous communities, we have to think about it being a pervasive part of any daily or ritual life of indigenous peoples.
Is there a particularly strong era, what many would call more the protest era, maybe primarily in the 60s, though obviously not exclusively to the 60s, and when there was such a big push with folk music?
It's definitely a strong period, and I think that we saw a convergence of a number of things in the U.S. in particular. In terms of the civil rights era and other social movements, including the Red Power movement, we saw the rise in profile of singer-songwriters who could give voice to, messages from so-called Indian country, from indigenous perspectives. So in our book, we feature a number of chapters that focus on folk singers such as Buffy St. Marie.
I learned a safety rope. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart, it won't let me.
Country western singers that kind of transcend that, the line between folk and country western, a singer such as Floyd Crow Westerman. We also look at the continuing folk tradition. So the line of influence from those two figures from the 1960s, 1970s, has been, the line of influence has been significant.
Is there a possibility for a renaissance of this sort of thing, Jeff, considering how much our society is even more focused on our changing demographics, how much more diverse we're becoming as a society?
I think there's definitely a renaissance, and it's in part because of the ascendancy of social media. It becomes so much easier for musicians to get their music out there through SoundCloud, through YouTube. So you have the opportunity for small fan bases to become much bigger, much more quickly. MTV ran a special fairly recently on the range of Native musicians, that are participating in multiple traditions from hip-hop to rap to reggae, punk, and so forth. The National Museum of the American Indian, a Smithsonian museum, had an exhibit fairly recently on this subject.
Jeff, we could talk about a lot more. I'm just going to ask you one more question, though, and it's a name that is probably more mainstream for a lot of folks, and someone who actually has Native American background but also was a pop musician,
yeah.
And that's Robbie Robertson of the band.
Perhaps you think the Creator sent you here to dispose of us as you see fit. If I thought you were sent by the Creator, I might be induced to think you had a right to dispose of me. Do not misunderstand me, but understand me fully with reference to my affection for the land.
His Mohawk identity was always a component of his identity, but whether it was a part of his public profile was another matter altogether. And definitely as he, you know, gained both notoriety and critical acclaim and had negotiating power within the industry, he developed a different sensibility about sharing parts of that identity through his music in a public way.
Northern Arizona University English professor Jeff Berglund, he's also the co-editor of the new book, Indigenous Pop, Native American Music from Jazz to Hip Hop.
Odd Donkey Kong, a staple of my Nintendo playing childhood, and part of a new exhibit making its world premiere at Arizona Science Center called Popnology.
The goal of this exhibit is to really connect our guests with pop culture and the idea that pop culture can influence technology.
That's Sari Custer, Vice President of Exhibits and Collections at Arizona Science Center. We spoke, coincidentally enough, right by a display of how video game systems have evolved. But those weren't the only mementos from my past there. You can see telephones that are actually connected to the wall with cords and film strip projectors and the hoverboard from Back to the Future.
He's on a hoverboard!
The exhibit is broken into four categories: how we move, how we connect, how we live and work, and how we play. Custer says it shows visitors what's come before and what could come next.
Arizona Science Center's mission is to inspire, educate, and engage curious minds through science. And what a great way to do that by helping them see all these really familiar pieces, the comic books, the movies, the TV shows that are from their childhood or that are really personal to them, that maybe had new ideas that eventually came to life and are now technologies we have in our everyday.
Is this a way to make science maybe more approachable to people?
Oh, I absolutely think so. The items that we're showcasing in Popnology are things that we definitely know of, but maybe don't realize that they had these types of origins.
Like Custer says, the fact that the cell phones in our pockets have more computing power than the entire Apollo mission. But Popnology is not just about nostalgia for cassettes and really bulky mobile phones. It also looks ahead. It includes the robot Baxter demonstrating his skills.
I mean, who needs legs when you get the smooth moves like these, right? How about that?
And it's also a place for some companies to show off what they're working on. Local Motors has the first 3D printed car on display. The company's Adam Kress says in some ways the exhibit is kind of like a showroom for his firm.
We're getting lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds going to museums and science centers all across North America to check out what we do. So there's definitely a big awareness play for us when it comes to what we're trying to do with Popnology and the vehicles that we'll debut.
Ann Kress says what's on display there now is not necessarily what visitors will see in other cities as the exhibit heads elsewhere.
Our goal long term, as Popnology goes on and travels for the next 2 years or so, is to replace the Strati that's there now with other vehicles that we create. That won't happen in the near term, but I could definitely imagine a year from today or possibly sooner them having a different Local Motors vehicle to display in their booth as opposed to the Strati that's there now.
The exhibit is described as a living, breathing one, and Arizona Science Center's Sari Custer says it could grow as it moves from city to city.
I think this exhibit has a lot to say about entrepreneurship. The ideas that you see presented here are something that were once just an idea. So those people that were 50 years ago thinking outside the box had to start somewhere and had to be able to sell their idea. And it's nice for our guests who maybe want to be entrepreneurs and who have these ideas to see the progression over time. And it's also reaffirming there's a great section here on things they got wrong, predictions that were wrong. You don't always have to be right, and failure is an option. You can fail learn from that and then move forward. I think that that's a really important piece here.
Custer says there are lessons to be learned from past technologies when looking to future ones, even when those past ones are from one's own childhood.
I get excited by saying, oh my goodness, something in my lifetime has played such an important role in how we live every day and the things that are coming out now that are really new and big and these advanced technologies, but something that's important from my life. I really liked, don't laugh at me, I really liked Back to the Future.
As did I.
Excellent. So Back to the Future had some really great technology moments and inspirations that came from there. We know, if you're a fan of the movie in Back to the Future 2, they were in the future, fax machines were all the rage. That's how they're communicating. Okay, they got that one wrong. But some of the things that we have now, video communication, they were communicating all the time. The hoverboards, while it might not be the same floating board, we do have hoverboards now. So they did get a few things right. And I think it's really exciting to see that those ideas started somewhere in my lifetime and have actually come to fruition.
Popnology will be at Arizona Science Center through mid-May. After that, it'll move on to New York. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.